Welcome to Valley Voices. I'm Amy Haddon Marsh. My guest today is longtime peace and social justice activist Peter Bergell. Peter lives in Salem, Oregon. I met him in the 1980s when he was on the staff of American Peace Test, a national anti-nuclear watchdog group that organized actions at the Nevada test site, among other things. Peter was a co-founder of that group. He was also the director of Citizen Action for Lasting Security in Oregon in the early 1980s and has worked on legislation related to nuclear freeze campaigns, divestment issues, ballot initiatives, and more. He's also the CEO of the Center for Energy Research and editor of the Peace Worker News magazine for Oregon Peace Works. That's where I saw his recent article titled Focus on the Silver Lining and why I invited him to the show today. He's on the phone from Salem. Welcome, Peter Bergell.
Thank you, Amy. Nice to be with you.
Yes, it's wonderful to talk with you after quite a while, I think.
It's been years.
Yeah, it has.
Since we last spoke. Mm-hmm.
Your work with peace and social justice issues covers decades. Peter, what got you into activism?
Well, I guess part of it was that my parents were followers of Albert Schweitzer and the idea of reverence for life, which they really kind of indoctrinated me into, I guess you'd say. But they were also they were academics, but they were also activists to a limited extent, and they kind of set me on that path, I think, originally. So I think a lot of this comes naturally. When I started getting involved in this kind of work as a young man, a lot of my compatriots' parents were unhappy with their involvement in it, but my parents were cheering. They were saying, "Yeah, good work. Keep doing
lucky
it.
You, yeah.
Yeah, lucky me, right. Exactly.
Was there any kind of turning point for you that really kind of set this kind of path to being for you? I mean, I know it's in your DNA, but was there any kind of turning point for you?
Well, there was, because I worked on a ballot measure to end the development of nuclear power plant construction here in Oregon mm-hmm. in 1979. And up till that point, I had occasionally worked as a staff person for some environmental or social change organization or other, but right. for the most part, I was a volunteer. At that point, my coworker said, "You know, you've got to go full time on this, or else we're not going to be able to make. We're not going to get our signatures." And so, I kind of turned it over and gave up my business as a plumbing and electrical repair person, mm-hmm. and said, "Okay, I'll do it." And so, we passed that ballot measure, and it's standing law here in Oregon now that there has to be an operating waste repository and a vote of the people before any more nuclear plants can be sited in Oregon.
Wow.
So
that's huge,
that
Peter.
That was kind of the turning point, I mm-hmm. guess. Yeah, that was an important step.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's so that's how mainly I know you is through the anti-nuclear work that you've been doing. And just want to thank you for that, because you've been doing quite a bit and it's been very effective.
Well, thank you very much.
Sure. You know, your article in the Peace Worker news magazine, mm-hmm. it's online. That's a great magazine. I think you're the third or fourth person that I've had on the show as a result of reading articles in the Peace Worker. So I will give that website out a little bit later in the show for people to head to. But your article, Focus on the Silver Lining, you compare the response to Donald Trump's election to the 1960s war effort. How does this compare?
Well, I think it compares very clearly, because as an activist and organizer, I've been kind of looking for the troops to line up and be willing to do something in the struggle for social justice, and with some short exceptions, that period that when we met, opposing nuclear weapons testing at the Nevada test site being an exception, mm-hmm. It didn't look like too many people were willing to go too far out of their way to do this kind of work. And since Donald Trump was elected, And this is what I think is the silver lining. I see people all around me and all across the country lining up to do all kinds of things, from protecting each other from racist attacks to supporting the water protectors at Standing Rock, mm-hmm. and countering hate speech with a more loving attitude, sustaining the environmental gains that we've struggled for all these years, and mm-hmm. continuing efforts to halt climate change, and maybe even reorganize the Democratic Party,
right.
and certainly to protect a woman's right to choose, and a lot more other things that people have been coming out of the woodwork to say, boy, you know, I have been kind of inactive for a while, but I can't let this go. And to me, that's very, very encouraging, and it provides us an opportunity to make some enormous changes that need to be made. Because let's be honest with each other and say that none of these problems is new. None of these problems was created by Donald Trump getting elected, mm-hmm. or by the election, or by anything like that. They all have roots deep in the past. And so it's time for us to take action on quite a range of different issues in order for us to survive as a country and as a species. So I welcome it.
So you're saying that there's a lot more willingness to take action. Do you think this will last? I mean,
well, that remains to be seen. I don't have a crystal ball. Mm-hmm. I made an error in that respect back in the 1960s when I thought we were building a peace movement that was so strong that we would never have to organize against war again. And I was wrong, because it wasn't a peace movement at all. It was an anti-war movement. And the differences are very significant, because, peace is work that we can do constantly to make things better on a whole lot of fronts. Mm-hmm. But anti-war is that movement was gone as soon as the war was gone. So
whether
it will last, that's an open question. But mm-hmm. certainly, unless we really get out and do something about the agenda that Donald Trump has in mind, I think that we're going to be looking at losses on every front, mm-hmm. in terms of all those issues that I just mentioned and a lot more. So I think this election is definitely a call to action, and I hope that many people respond to it, and not only in a emergency sort of way, but in the kind of way where that says, I'm going to settle in for the long haul, not only to beat back these initiatives that I don't support right now, but also to make the world a better place. And I think that's the potential that opens up before us now. Things can either get a lot worse, mm-hmm. or they could get a lot better.
Well, why do you think the incoming administration is so frightening?
Well, I think that they're enormously frightening for a great many reasons. I mean, one of them is that the permission that has been given by the Trump by the Trump candidacy, mm-hmm. not the administration yet, but by the candidacy, mm-hmm. to racism and misogyny and xenophobia and those kinds what I think are very negative attitudes, mm-hmm. On the part of people, that those things have been given permission to come out into the light, a lot more than they have been doing for some time. That's not to say that they didn't exist, but he's made it kind of acceptable, mm-hmm. to express some of these views, at least in some quarters. And we're seeing a lot more of that kind of thing. So that's one area, and that's a big one. Mm-hmm. He's also indicated that he doesn't believe in climate change, that it's human-caused, and he's appointed climate deniers to his cabinet already, indicating that he intends to follow through on that. And then he isn't much of a lover of environmentalism in any form, and I think he believes that any kind of a business interest that is hampered by environmental concerns
and regulations
is being hampered unreasonably, and, you know, I just don't agree with him on mm-hmm. that, and I think there's a lot of other people in this country that don't agree about mm-hmm. that. We should definitely make sure that he doesn't point the government that way.
Right. You know, you talk about how resistance is necessary right now, and, you know, there are just all these different words of protest, demonstration, resistance, struggle. What do you mean by resistance?
Well, I think protest is one of the things that comes to mind very quickly when somebody talks about resistance. And I don't have anything against protests. I've mm-hmm. done a lot of it in my life. And in fact, we met doing that. But
yes, we did.
at this point, I think we're in a situation where we need to go beyond protest and start demonstrating what it is that we really do want, and mm-hmm. and figure out ways to refuse to tolerate what we don't want. And, you know, simple examples are, you know, a lot of people are wearing the safety pin now mm-hmm. to let people know that they're safe people. Mm-hmm. If other folks are threatened by some of these attitudes that I've been talking about. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that people can do is wear that safety pin and then be prepared to back it up. You know, in other words, if you see any kind of racism or misogyny or xenophobia being acted out in your presence, that you make a commitment to interrupt that and replace it with some kind of a positive energy. That's one thing that people can do.
Well, you are wearing a safety pin, aren't you? You're a person who wears a safety pin.
I am. I'm wearing one.
Have you had any cause? Have you had any cause to back that up?
Not yet.
No.
I've been fortunate in that most of the comment that I've got on it is, you know, like, what's that about?
Mm-hmm.
And then I explain it to people, and they say, oh, that's good.
Mm-hmm.
That's good. I like that.
Yeah.
But, you know, I live in a relatively, blue area where this is maybe not as big a problem as it is in some mm-hmm. Some other places in the country. And so I'm just saying I'm lucky here that I haven't had to actually step into situations, mm-hmm. but I have heard of people in this area having to do that, and I certainly support that and hope that I will do as well.
You know, I want
that arises, and I'm sure it will.
Yeah, I'm sure it will too. But before we take a brief break, I saw something today that occurred in late April. So this news is not brand new, but mm-hmm. Grant Town, maybe you heard about this, but in Western Pennsylvania, Grant Township passed a law that protects residents from arrest if they protest this energy company's creation of an injection well. And basically, they think this law is the first in the United States to legalize nonviolent civil disobedience against toxic wastewater injection wells. Did you hear mm-hmm. about that?
I have heard something about that, and I think that is the brainchild of an organization called CELDF, which mm-hmm. stands for, just a minute,
Community Legal Defense Environmental Fund, or something like that.
There you go. Thank you.
Is that right?
I think
I
that's
have
very
it in front
close.
Of me.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, and I'm very impressed with that group. I think they're doing some really good work and really pushing on the envelope of what we have regarded as defense of democracy in the mm-hmm. past. So. Yeah, I did hear some whispers about that, and I think that's really exciting that's happening.
Well, I want to let listeners know that this is Valley Voices, and my guest today is longtime peace and social justice activist Peter Burgell. You can find his articles and other writers at peaceworker.org. You know, in your article, Peter, you talk about something called the 100 Days of Peace. What is that?
Mm-hmm.
What is it?
Well, that's an idea that was suggested by a friend of my wife's and mine here in Salem. And I read about it in the daily newspaper. She had an op-ed in which she said, well, why don't we do this? Why don't when Donald Trump takes his gets inaugurated on the 20th of January and starts to lay out his agenda over the first 100 days, which is always kind of the defining period of a new administration, why don't we start having 100 days of peace and justice during which we lay out our agenda of what where the country ought to be going and what we expect to see. And I thought that was a brilliant idea, because what that does is it erects an umbrella under which a lot of different kinds of things of organizing work can be done, from protest on the one end to very specific actions on the other, and everything in between. And, you know, so resisting violence in our homes and workplaces, you know, in terms of how all the ways it's coming in, insisting that our taxes be used to for the good of the community, and resisting that if they're not. When you see irresponsible marketing and marketers, we can boycott them and reward good corporate citizens with our business.
Now, is this a coordinated effort? Is this something that...
Well, not yet. It's I'm just starting to throw it out there. There's a website called 100dayspeace.org. That's 100dayspeace.org. And she's kind of put that up as her contribution, and she's willing to post things to it and kind of keep it up to date. I got real excited about it and said, well, I'm going to start putting this out to my contacts across the country. And I've just begun doing that. Putting the article in the Peace Worker was one. I also sent it to an organization called Peace Voice, which is run by a friend of mine in Portland. And he gets articles like this out to thousands of news outlets every, he does it pretty much every day.
Well,
so, and he sent it out recently, so we'll just see what, you know, we'll see how it, whether it, it takes hold. But I'm also mentioning it at community meetings that I'm attending, and so far the response has been very positive. People say, yeah, I like that idea. I think that's a great idea. So we'll see whether it really takes hold and whether people organize, because I think one of the things that's really important about this is that it needs to be not a top-down kind of effort. It needs to be something that takes hold in a local community, and then people say, yeah, let's have this as part of our 100 days of peace and justice, or let's have that as, you know, whatever the need is in the community. You were talking about a community back in Pennsylvania that was looking at the problem of injection wells and fracking and that sort of thing. And so maybe that's the problem that they need to focus on. Here in our community, we have, you know, we have a strong effort to build a bridge across the Willamette River that is very, very extensive, and that most people don't think we need, but which the city seems determined to push forward. And so that's one thing that that we could put under this. Then, you know, I think the Trump administration is going to give us a lot of things that we can say, no, we need to find a way to go to get around that.
A lot of ideas.
Yeah, so lots of different things. You know, they're going to be coming up in the energy field. They're going to come up in the civil liberties field. They're going to come up in the civil rights and human rights field. And they're going to come up in the good government field, as well as the peace area. So there are lots of things that could fit under this. And I just invite everybody to grab it and run with it as much, you know, with as much creativity as they can manage.
So this is bigger than simply recycling or changing light bulbs. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's nothing wrong with any of that. I think that's all very important. But what we need to be doing is thinking about way more powerful responses to the problems, because, you know, the light bulb changing thing bespeaks a personal change of lifestyle, and I think that's a good thing to be doing. But also, we urgently need a tax on carbon, is my opinion, and that will be the thing that will probably push the climate change work in the most positive direction.
Okay.
Then we need to have some support for the electrification of vehicles and all that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that points to some lobbying and that kind of work. But it also invites people to say, well, I wonder if we could have a business here in town, in whatever town they're in, that promotes better energy mm-hmm. use and that kind of thing. And there are a lot of examples of that mm-hmm. kind of thing having been done in various communities. And I'm hoping that people will come up with these kinds of ideas and launch them during 100 Days of Peace.
Or maybe it could be, maybe I can grow a garden in my backyard or
something as small as
that.
Especially if you've never done it before.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, if you've never done it before, I mean, it's a personal thing, and it's an
try that again.
Easy for you to say, organizing thing that people can do.
Well, one of the things before we sign off, Peter, we have about 4.5 minutes here. Believe it or not.
Okay, we never took the break.
Yeah, we did just very briefly. I said that would be very brief, but anyway, would you take a minute and define nonviolence? And talk about why you think it's so effective. I mean, here is something that has been kind of bothering me lately. But Standing Rock is an example of how it can work. Although
right.
Energy Transfer Partners has not really committed to stopping work on the pipeline. The other case.
Yet.
The other case is the Malheur Wildlife occupation by the Bundy Boys and their followers. They had weapons, and law enforcement did not fire water cannon at them or pepper spray or harass them with aircraft and sound cannon. Same with the Nevada Bundy standoff, where snipers were ready to fire on law enforcement. To me, the Bundy cases showed that violence can work to a certain degree.
Well, what did it work to do?
It kept law enforcement away. They didn't get... I mean, I guess one person died.
Yeah, I mean,
but
they were sitting in a...
they were sort of allowed to do what they wanted to do.
Well, they were sitting in a very remote wildlife refuge, and they did a little bit of damage to it, but, you know, not a really serious amount, as I understand it. And they were hoping that they were going to start a movement, and what happened instead was that the community around them said, no, this is not what we want.
Mm-hmm.
You're not speaking for us,
mm-hmm.
for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so when you say it worked, I say, no, it didn't work. It didn't work at all.
Okay.
People reacted, for the most part, with disgust. And the law enforcement said, it's the off season for the wildlife refuge and we can wait them out. And I thought it was actually a pretty good decision that the law enforcement made there,
mm-hmm.
Because why get somebody killed over this?
Well, somebody did get killed over that.
Well, somebody did get killed mm-hmm. over it, but you know, it could have been much, much mm-hmm. worse than that if law enforcement decided to go in with all guns blazing or something like that. And they started to have standoffs.
Right. So why is nonviolence so effective? I mean, we got 2 minutes. So
okay. Well,
why is it?
One of the reasons that nonviolence is so effective is that it's not about winning and losing. It's about finding out who has a wider vista on the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's really important. And so it seeks to persuade rather than to coerce, which makes it much more effective in the long run. In fact, recent research by Erica Chenoweth, if your readers don't know about Erica Chenoweth, they should probably check it out because it's really exciting and groundbreaking kind of work that's been done. And she has done some research that unequivocally shows that nonviolence is about twice as likely to be successful as violence, at least in the case of attempted regime changes. And this is with a study that spanned the entire 20th century and the beginning of the 21st century and looked at, 343 different instances. So they found out that, first of all, nonviolence is twice as likely to be successful at achieving the ends of the people who were using it,
mm-hmm.
and second of all, that it was twice as likely to be long-lasting as violence was.
Mm-hmm.
And that is by no means to be taken as a guarantee of success,
right.
but it is a matter of probabilities. You know, if you undertake a change of some kind and you undertake it nonviolently, chances are you're going to be successful more likely than if you use violence.
Well, Peter Burgell, quickly, we're almost out of time.
Okay. All right. Well, furthermore, it makes it a lot easier for young people, old people, alter-able people to become involved, and that makes it a lot easier to get bigger, which it needs to do.
Well, Peter Burgell, thanks so much for taking the time to join me today.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your, the work you're doing there, Amy. I think that's very laudable that you're letting people know what's happening there.
That was Peter Burgell from Salem, Oregon. You can find his work and other writers at peaceworker.org. And to find out more about the 100 Days of Peace and Justice, go to 100dayspeace.org. That's 100dayspeace.org. This is Valley Voices.